Well, let's take our Bibles and open to the book of Hebrews. We want to persevere in our worship, our service of that Lamb who is worthy of every effort we put forth on this earth to know Him better, to follow Him, to live in His service, and to continue faithfully in the covenant that He has secured for us by His blood. Hebrews chapter 11, and persevere is the series title. Tonight we look at the faith of the patriarchs. We're in chapter 11, verses 8 through 22. In verse 1 of that chapter, we saw this descriptor that faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. And then once again, our October verse, number 6, but without faith, it is impossible to please Him. For he that cometh to God must believe that He is, and that He is a rewarder of them that diligently seek Him. Remember that key term, coming to God, is what an important theme in verses in chapters 1 through 10, the idea of approaching God for communion and worship. We can't do that without the ministry of Jesus Christ. In the Old Testament, they could do that only in a form and only from a distance. But we're commanded to come boldly, and we must do so. Now we're instructed in verse 6 of chapter 11 with faith, a faith that believes that God is, a faith that believes God is a rewarder of them that diligently seek Him. Last week we looked at the faith of Abel and the faith of Enoch, the faith of Noah. We'll add five more names to that list in the Hall of Faith this evening, starting in verse 8. Let's go ahead and read from verse 8 down through verse 22 to get a picture of this evening's text, and we'll go back through it, making some notes and drawing some applications there. Chapter 11, starting in verse 8, by faith, Abraham, when he was called to go out into a place which he should after receive for inheritance, obeyed, and he went out not knowing whither he went. By faith he sojourned in the land of promise, as in a strange country, dwelling in tabernacles with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he looked for a city which hath foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Through faith also Sarah herself received strength to conceive seed, and was delivered of a child when she was past age, because she judged him faithful who had promised. Therefore sprang there even of one, and him as good as dead, so many as the stars of the sky in multitude, and as the sand which is by the seashore innumerable. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, and were persuaded of them, and embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For they that say such things declare plainly that they seek a country, and truly, if they had been mindful of that country from whence they came out, they might have had opportunity to have returned. But now they desire a better country, that is, an heavenly. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for He hath prepared for them a city. By faith, Abraham, when he was tried, offered up Isaac, and he that had received the promise offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said that in Isaac shall thy seed be called, accounting that God was able to raise him up even from the dead, from whence also he received him in a figure. By faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau concerning things to come. By faith, Jacob, when he was a dying, blessed both the sons of Joseph and worshipped, leaning upon the top of his staff. By faith, Joseph, when he died, made mention of the departing of the children of Israel and gave commandment concerning his bones. These patriarchs, who we add to our list tonight of those exemplars of the faith, elders, verse 2 calls them, from the Old Testament, to whom we look for an illustration of the manifest. What does it look like when we take the new covenant faith? Because this faith that we have is connected to the faith of these Old Testament believers, our New Testament faith that brings us an access to God by Jesus' blood looks like it did for these Old Testament believers in terms of the way that we behave toward God, specifically His instructions toward us and His promises for us. Let's remember our definition for faith. We've said, based on verse 1, based on verse 6 especially, that faith is simply believing that God is who he says he is and that he will do all he has promised to do. He has done all he has promised to do. He is doing all he has promised to do, and he will do all he has promised to do. Now, that belief that's used in this definition is not a simple mental awareness. It's not even limited to an inner heart belief, but it has to be a belief that manifests itself in an outward change of behavior, namely toward obedience. And so that's the first point I really want us to be impressed with as we look at the patriarchs this evening, is that faith is a belief, but it's a belief to the point of obedience. Faith believes, but not just in the head, not even merely in the heart, but in the hands, in the feet, in the eyes, in the mouth, in the attitude, in the outward conformity and inward submission to the commandments of God. Faith believes to the point of obedience. Look again at verse 8, where it tells us that by faith, Abraham, when he was called to go out into a place which he should after receive for an inheritance, obeyed. And several times in the New Testament, that obedient act of faith is given to us as an example to show what it looks like to follow God's commandments, even when we can't see all of the details about how that will play out. Sometimes when we think about Abraham's call, we picture this man in Ur of the Chaldees and God coming to him and giving him interesting proposal. Hey, Abraham, if you'll leave behind Ur and go out to a place I'll show you, though you might have security here, though you might have wealth here, though you might have family here, if you go to where I'm telling you, I'm going to make a great nation of you. I'm going to give you a bigger land. I'm going to bless all nations through you. Abraham, what do you think? And Abraham considered his options and said, you know what, I think I will take that risk and I'll go with what God says and I'll give that a try. And that's not really very accurate. Now, part of those details are what happened, but don't think of it as this option, this invitation that Abraham was given, where he had this chance to kind of add on and go above the norm and go into, you know, Hebrews chapter 11 type heroic faith and really experience all this bonus that God had special for him because he chose to do over and above what others would do and just live by faith. There's not that kind of distinction. It's not this faith and faith obedience is not like this optional extra level for Christians that's above and beyond God's expectations. It's kind of the bonus material that's optional if you want to do extra credit. Please don't think of it that way. Rather, God's call to Abraham wasn't an invitation to some new option, some alternate course that he could weigh his options and decide what he wanted to do. Rather, God appeared to Abraham and said, go. Go out to a land I'll show you. Here's what I'm going to do for you. Okay, it's not just blind faith. Here are the promises, Abraham, but you are to go. Abraham's choice was not, well, should I live here in security and try to worship God here? Or can I, you know, should I venture out in this kind of unknown and worship God in that way? No, his choices were, do I stay where I'm comfortable or will I obey? And Abraham chose to obey. And that's verse 8. When God called him out of his land, Abraham obeyed. What was it? Now we know the end of the story. We know that this works out. We know that God does make a great nation. We know that God does give a promised land. We know that through Abraham's seed, specifically the singular seed of Jesus Christ, that all the nations of the earth are blessed, including you and I. It'd be interesting to take a raise of hands and do a survey and see what nations are represented in our heritage based on our ancestry. But each one of us must be thankful that God fulfilled his promise to Abraham, continues to fulfill his promise to Abraham to bless all nations through his seed. But what was it about Abraham, about Abraham's demeanor, his response to God, that caused God to outpour his blessings on Abraham? Well, of course, primarily it was God's grace It was God's grace completely, but Abraham became a candidate for being the channel of God's grace based on his response, and specifically what element of his response? We would say his faith, but let's look at a couple verses. All right, now this will be on the screen. Genesis 15, verses 5 and 6. God brings Abraham forth abroad and says, "Look now toward the heaven and tell or count the stars if thou be able to number them." God says to Abraham, "So shall thy seed be." Abraham believed in the Lord, and he, God, counted it to him, Abraham, for righteousness. This great blessing from God to Abraham, what was the basis of that from a human standpoint? What part of Abraham's response? He believed. He believed, and because of his belief, God blesses. All right, now consider God's word to Jacob in the next generation, a couple generations later, Genesis 26, verses 4 and 5. "I will make thy seed to multiply as the stars of heaven," says God, "and will give unto thy seed all these countries, and in thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed." Why? What basis? What human response prompts this or facilitates this? Because that Abraham obeyed my voice, kept my charge and my commandments, my statutes and my laws. So what was it about Abraham's response that opened the doors for God's blessing upon him? It was his obedience. Well, is there a contradiction here between what God says to Abraham and what God says to Jacob? What was it about Abraham's response that facilitated God's blessing through him? Was it his obedience or was it his faith? The answer is yes. It was both. It was the belief that manifested itself in obedience. James puts it this way in chapter 2 and verse 22 of his epistle. Faith, that's the belief, God is who he says he is and he'll do all he's promised to do, wrought or meshed or put together with his works, that's the obedient external behavior, and by works, the outside obedience, was the faith, the inner belief, made perfect, made complete. So faith is incomplete if it's only head knowledge. It's incomplete if it's only a belief in the heart. It is complete once that head knowledge transfers to heart belief, and that manifests itself in outward obedience. Faith believes to the point of obedience. Number two, faith obeys through sight's uncertainties. Remember this dichotomy that we're given, this choice between faith and sight. We look forward to the time when our faith shall be sight, but what is now of sight is not faith. In other words, if we can see it, it doesn't take faith to believe it. Faith is the evidence of seeing things hoped for, the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. It is believing God's promise, even though we can't always see tangibly, we can't perceive with our earthly senses all of the details, all of the logistics, all of the steps in between his command and his fulfillment of his promise. So faith obeys through sight's uncertainties. Look back at verse 8. "By faith Abraham, when he was called to go out into a place which he should have to receive for an inheritance, obeyed, and he went out not knowing whither he went." Sight's uncertainties. Hey, Abraham, go out of Ur. Where are we going? I'll tell you when we get there. And he has uncertainties. Well, where am I going to live? Where am I going to sleep? How am I going to care for my wife? Are my flocks and herds going to do okay? We don't know what kind of land, what kind of pastures we're going to, what kind of water will be available. What about my family? What about my estate here? What? So many uncertainties that came from the tangibles of earthly material goods and securities. But faith obeys through sight's uncertainties. It seems counterintuitive sometimes to follow God, because anyone would have told Abraham, "Hey, you're at retirement age. You're here. You're secured. You got the house paid off. Your parents live close by. You got, you know, your legacy is here. Everybody knows you. This is the place to stay." No, it would be crazy to venture out and go into the unknown, especially if you don't know where you're going. But faith obeys through sight's uncertainties. You know, the world says, and sometimes this is true, have you heard the saying, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush, right? The idea is what you have that you can cling to is better to hang on to that than to go after more if it's uncertain. If you had to let go of that bird in the hopes of getting two other birds, you might end up with none. So a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. That's fine in some things, you know, if you're talking about, you know, investing finances or things like that. But think about God's call. When God gives a commandment, he's very often asking us to release that bird in our hands. And he's promising that there are two in the bush that will be obtained through obedience. How am I going to get them? What about what lies between me and the bush? What will be my means of, how will I be provided for in the meantime? Many uncertainties from the perspective of sight, but faith obeys through sight's uncertainties. Specifically, we see that faith led the patriarchs to the obedience of adopting a pilgrim mentality. It was, hey, you're a settled person in a well-established city, which there was if you read about it, but you're called to become a nomad. Now you're a homeless person, a wanderer, a vagrant, a pilgrim, a sojourner, an exile. We see that language here, verse 9, by faith he sojourned in a land of promise as in a strange country. Again, at the end of verse 13, that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. This ties into our theme for 1 Peter, as Peter writes to believers of this age and says, to the strangers. He reminds us of our pilgrim identity, our exile in terms of our life on this earth as earthly citizens. God's call to Abraham and each of the patriarchs, and in a sense to every believer, is a call to the obedience of the life of a sojourner. To say, I will not cling to the securities of earthly stimuli, of earthly material goods. I will not allow that bird in the hand to keep me from obeying God, even despite sight's uncertainties. Abraham saw the unseen heavenly city. Did you notice that? That's verse 13 and 14. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off. Abraham recognized that when this covenant was given to him, that it wasn't one, all of these promises that God gave, some of them he would see signs of in his lifetime. But when God promises to make great nations of him, he's already 75. All right, he'll be 100 by the time. Is that right? I think I've got the ages right. By the time he has his first child. All right, so Abraham knows, okay, this is already really stretching it to assume that I would have a child. But when God says great nations, obviously that's something that requires generations of time. So Abraham knew this isn't a my lifetime promise. This isn't a retirement package that God is offering me. This is a promise that transcends my earthly life. When God says, through your seed will all the nations of the earth be blessed, Abram knows, well, that's not going to happen before I die. That's going to take generations. That's going to take years and years for God to bring that to fruition. Abraham was looking not just at, well, if I go God's way, maybe I'll have a better house. Maybe I'll be more healthy. Maybe I'll have a more comfortable time in my last couple decades of life. No, Abraham knew that these promises were past his lifetime type of promises. So what Abraham was really looking for was not even, notice, he wasn't even focused on Canaan. Abraham's journeyings wasn't about, well, if I can just get to Canaan, then that's the promised land, and then I'll be all set. Because we see him get to Canaan, and he keeps traveling. And he leaves and comes back, and even when he's in Canaan, he considers himself a traveler. For example, when Sarah dies, Genesis 23, verse 4, Abram goes to these people that do own land there in Canaan and says, I am a stranger and sojourner with you. Give me a possession of a burying place with you that I may bury my dead out of my sight. Here's Abraham in the promised land, the land of promise, right? And he still considers himself a stranger and a pilgrim. So when verse 13 says he's looking for a city, don't think Canaan. Think instead of a man who was looking for the fulfillment of a promise that he knew would not come to full fruition till long after his earthly lifetime. And so the writer of Hebrews specifically tells us that that city that Abraham was looking for is a heavenly city whose builder and maker is God, verse 10. He's looking for a heavenly city. He was, like one songwriter said, kind of homesick for a country where I've never been before. Or like another songwriter said, there's a land that's fairer than day, and by faith, we can see it afar. We've never seen it. You ever seen it? I've never seen it, except through the eyes of faith. The Father waits over the way to prepare us a dwelling place there. Do you believe that? I believe that. Abraham believed that. Verse 13, he died in faith, not having received the promise, but having seen those promises afar off. And despite sight's uncertainties, he was persuaded of them. He embraced them. He confessed that he was a stranger and pilgrim on this earth. For they that say such things declare plainly that they seek a country. Abraham was looking for a country. He was looking to go home. He was homesick for a country. He said, like another songwriter, this world is not my home. I'm just a passing through. My treasures are laid up somewhere beyond the blue. The angels beckon me from heaven's open door, and I can't feel at home in this world anymore. So if you asked Abraham, Abraham, where's home to you? Where's home to you? If you ask me that question, okay, I spent my first 25 years approximately in Wisconsin. So someone would say, hey, that's a Wisconsin boy. For the last 10 years, I've been in Indiana. You'd say, oh, well, that's a Hoosier. Where's home to you? I'll say Indiana, specifically Indianapolis. If you live here, I heard this on the radio. The technical term is you are an Indianapolitan. And so if someone says, where's home for you? You could say, I'm an Indianapolitan. But if someone asked Abraham, he wouldn't say, well, I'm a Canaanite, I'm a new Canaanite, I'm the inheritor of this big promised land. This is my home. I might not have received it yet, but this is home for me. Or if you asked Abraham, he might have said, where's home for you, Abraham? He'd say, oh, I live 75 years in Ur of the Chaldees, back in Haran, and that's home for me. Abraham wouldn't have given either of those answers. If you asked Abraham, Abraham, where's home for you? He'd say, well, I'm a sojourner here. I'm a stranger here. I have nothing here except this little burial plot. My home is beyond the river. I've got a home way over in the glory land. I've got a home that God is preparing. I've got a heavenly city, a city with foundations, a city whose builder and maker is God. But faith means we have to obey through the uncertainties between here and there. Can you obey despite some uncertainties? We've talked many times about that example of Abraham. It's not blind faith, but it is a step out, trusting God, a step out where you don't know where that other foot is going to land. But it's not a blind faith. It's based on God's promise, but acknowledging that sight has many uncertainties before I get there. So if God leads you to witness to someone, to share the gospel with someone, what does God promise in regards to our sharing of the gospel? He promises to give us words to say. He promises to bless our efforts with fruit. He promises that his word will not return void. He causes us to expect that many will reject the gospel, but his promise is also that when God's people are faithful in sharing it, that some will get saved. And so if I believe these promises, I will act out in faith-fueled obedience despite sight's uncertainties. Well, what am I going to say? Well, what if they shut me down? Well, what if they ask a question I don't know the answer to? Well, what if this person's on the clock and I'm distracting them? What if it'll be awkward and I'll actually turn them off to the gospel? What? And all of sight's uncertainties can cause us to cling to that bird in the hand of my comfort and my ease and my convenience. When God says, step out and obey. Hey, those of you living at home with your parents, when God said, you know, the Bible has hundreds of commandments, one specifically for minors, children, obey your parents. Honor your father and mother. But what about my dreams? What about my plans? And mom and dad just don't get it. And so if I'm to obey God by obeying my parents, there's so much at stake. There's so many uncertainties. If I just obey my parents, they don't see eye to eye with my idea of where my life should be going. Obey. Faith believes to the point of obedience. Faith obeys through sight's uncertainties. But how? What about my dreams? What about my plans? Trust God and obey. What if God calls me to, we have the instructions of Scripture. Abraham had a direct revelation from God. Okay, we have to make sure when we look at Abraham, our application is not, hey, all of us should leave home and just, kind of see where God leads. No, God told Abraham that. I don't think he's told any of us that through explicit revelation. Okay, we have Scripture. Now, God can lead and burden you for specific ministries and call you to certain ministries. But he will use the Scripture to work in our hearts and to give us the commandments for how we ought to live. And so when he says that we ought to be faithful in his word, that we ought to be faithful in church, that we ought to be giving in church, we could look at all of those things and say, but what does that mean for, well, but if I do that, how am I supposed to? And sight has many uncertainties, but faith obeys. Faith obeys. Faith believes to the point of obedience. Okay, what about Sarah? As she's mentioned here in verse 11, through faith, Sarah herself received strength to conceive seed. She was delivered of a child when she was past age. Do you expect to see Sarah in the hall of faith? Do you remember her response when she heard that promise from God that she herself would have a child? She'd already tried to go around that by giving Hagar to Abram, and that didn't work, and she was trying to figure out how this is going to happen, and then the Lord appears to Abraham, and Sarah's in the tent, and God says, surely Sarah will have a child. Do you remember her response? Genesis 18, therefore Sarah laughed within herself, saying, after I am waxed old, shall I have pleasure? My Lord, that is how she referred to Abraham, being old also. The Lord said unto Abraham, wherefore did Sarah laugh, saying, shall I of a surety bear a child which am old? Is anything too hard for the Lord? At the time appointed, I will return unto thee according to the time of life, and Sarah shall have a son. And Sarah denied, saying, I laughed not, for she was afraid. And he said, nay, but thou didst laugh. And that's our account of Sarah. You expect to find her then in the hall of faith when she laughed at the promise of God? Well, let's consider this. Okay, if Sarah had no faith, her attitude was one of defiance, how would she respond when God said, wherefore did you laugh? A defiant, faithless person might say, well, of course I laughed. Do you see this silver hair? Do you see these wrinkles? Do you see this stooped spine, these wrinkled, curved fingers? Do you hear my knees? Of course I laughed. But not Sarah. She had laughed within herself. You ever do that? Not even an out loud laugh, just inside. So she's, oh no, I didn't laugh. She was afraid. And when God corrects her, God rebukes her, all we can take from the silence of Scripture is that she accepts that, and she goes on to play her role, her part, in God's plan, and God uses her in that way. Here's something we could take away from that. Hey, you don't need a superhero faith to approach God in worship. Like verse 6 says, to come to God. You don't need some extra level Old Testament saint, halo grade faith to approach God in worship. You just need to be willing to put aside sight's uncertainties and obediently play your part in God's grand design. Sarah did that, and here she is listed for us as an example. She is past age, verse 11. Which is more than you could say for her husband, who is described in verse 12 as good as dead. All right, in terms of their childbearing possibilities, talk about sight's uncertainties. Okay, I don't think AARP publishes a lot of maternity articles, right? Bye-bye baby, supply store, they don't offer a senior discount. All right, there are sight's uncertainties when God says, hey, here's a woman past age, here's a man as good as dead, they're going to have a child. Faith sometimes appears unreasonable. And this is all the world sees, especially the skeptic who compares our faith to their reason. And it's set up as that kind of dichotomy. Faith has to be unreasonable. Faith has to be illogical. Faith has to be unbased. Faith has to contradict, you know, science or observation. That is, as we see in Abraham and Sarah's case, sometimes true on the surface when it comes to sight. When it comes to the immediately observable, we do have to sometimes suspend sight's uncertainties, but it's not blindly, it's based on what God tells us. Think of it this way. Have you ever maybe seen an illusionist, either on TV or at a show, you know, magician, and they do these amazing things. All right, if you, maybe you'd never grown up seeing any such thing. Suppose you're transplanted from another culture and you just see this, a crowd of people that sees this that they've never seen before, and they say, wow, this guy makes a coin come from nowhere. He can draw a pigeon out of thin air. He can pull a whole deck of cards out of his mouth. He can saw a woman in half and make her whole again. And we can watch tricks like that and be very impressed and bewildered and have our minds blown and say, how in the world? There's no logical explanation for that. But have you ever seen the tricks revealed? Have you ever had one of those revealed where they say, well, here's the trick. Well, the magician over here distracting you, here's what's happening behind the curtain, here's what's happening beneath the sleeve, here's what's happening with the sleight of hand. Have you ever had that where the trick is revealed to you and then you see it again and it's like, oh, well, that's not impressive at all. It's actually quite simple. And who are these people oohing and aah, applause, you know, a big deal. You know, this is actually, there's nothing impressive here. But for the people who haven't had it revealed, they're amazed and are astounded, and all they can go by is what they see, what they perceive with their senses. And it's as though we are in that theater, and behind us is the Maker who taps us on the shoulder and whispers to us the secret of what is happening before us. And suddenly, we see the bigger picture. We're afforded a peek behind the curtain, to the point that where everyone else, all they perceive leads them to conclusions and questions that they can't answer, we have the answers, and we say, no, she wasn't sawed in half. And the person can say, well, that's what I saw with my eyes. That's what's observable. So your conclusion, based on my eyewitness report, yours is illogical, yours is unreasonable, yours is anti-science, when the reality is we have perceived with the eyes of faith through spiritual information of the revelation of God to see that which cannot be perceived with earth's sight. The lost are captivated by the world, but there are important realities they can't explain because all they have to go on is what they perceive with their earthly senses. So to go beyond what's immediately perceived with the earthly senses is not unreasonable, though on the surface it will sometimes appear to be. It's not illogical, though from a tangible, experiential standpoint it can often appear to be. And that brings us to point three, which is faith believes to the point of obedience. Faith obeys through sight's uncertainties. And then faith believes to the end of God's promise. Notice that when we say that the sight's uncertainties, it's not that anything about God's promise is uncertain. It's about the things that we see that often don't appear very concrete, yet we know that God's promise is certain. Now note the promise language in our passage, verse 9. The land of promise, the end of the verse, heirs with him of the same promise. The end of verse 11, who had faith, counted faithful, who had promised. Verse 13, they died in faith, not having received the promises. But the end of verse 17, had received the promises, offered up his only begotten son. And things, at the end of verse 20, things to come, the promises of God were the motivation, the information of the patriarch's faith. They didn't say, well, I don't know what's going to happen, but I'll go ahead and follow. No, they did know what was going to happen because God told them. By faith, we, verse 3, believe that the world we live in was created by God. We didn't see that. Some people could take only what's observable and reproducible and take this sampling of this or that and say, look, it appears that you're wrong. And it's not because we're wrong. It's because sight will have some uncertainties, but we've had that peek behind the curtain of the truth that some have willingly allowed their eyes to be veiled to. Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, they were looking for something beyond themselves, beyond their lifetimes, beyond this earth. Sarah was past age. Abraham was as good as dead. Look at Isaac. When he's being offered on the altar, verse 19, Abraham, the only one on the mountain as far as sight was concerned, no one to stop him from plunging that knife, which he was truly determined to do and in or on the verge of the act of doing. In from a physical sight standpoint, Isaac was as good as dead. But he accounted that God was able to raise him up even from the dead. Death wasn't going to be a barrier. By faith, Isaac. What is it about Isaac and Jacob and Joseph that's being commended here? Like all it said is they blessed their sons before they died. How is that faith? By faith Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau concerning things to come. Isaac could be put in with those of the previous verses that, you know, verse 13 says they died in faith, not having received the promises. Isaac didn't get to see it all, but he blesses Jacob and Esau with the knowledge that, hey, the fulfillments of God's promise are still to come. And when you look at the text of his blessings on Jacob, his blessings on Esau, they are obviously future-oriented blessings that are foreseeing and anticipating the blessings that God had promised truly coming to fruition. Jacob, verse 21, when he was a dying, blessed his sons. Bless the sons of Joseph, leaning on the top of his staff. So here's the guy who lived his whole life as a sojourner. Remember when he gets to Egypt and Pharaoh asks about him, you know, how old are you? And Jacob says, the years of thy servant's pilgrimage are 130. He saw himself as a temporary dweller on this earth. He was looking forward to the promises, the fulfillment of which he knew would transcend his lifetime, yet even in his dying breath he clung to. As he blesses the sons and saying, hey kids, God's blessing is still coming, and some of it's going to come through you. Some of it that I didn't experience is going to come in the next generation. And eventually all of it's going to get here. But even as I am, in the old English, a dying, I cling to faith. I die in faith, believing those promises, though I have not yet seen them with earth's sight. By faith, Joseph, when he died, made mention of the departing of the children of Israel. Hey, they're all happily living there in Egypt with plenty, with land, with food, with status. But Joseph knew there's more than this. This isn't the long term. We're eventually, even though things are going fine, he knew we're eventually leaving here. And I don't want my roots to be here. Hey, when you go, take my bones with you, because I don't want any connection to something that's apart from God's promise. He looked ahead, and so we look ahead, believing to the end of God's promise. I have just a quick video that shows something of the city that we're looking for. The Bible talks about the city that John sees coming from heaven. Heavens pass away, the earth melts with fervent heat, a new heaven and a new earth are created. Abraham, we can assume, didn't have all of this detail. He didn't have as much concrete imagination to cling to as he looked for a city. He just knew this would be a city with foundations. Well, what about Ur? Didn't Ur have foundations? It was a solid city. No, he knew that cities of earth rise and fall. Kingdoms of this planet rise and fall. There's one city with foundations. That's what he was looking for. If we could have this video, it gives us an idea of the scale. In Revelation, we read about its cubits or its stadia, and it gives us the rough idea of the dimensions, approximately 1,400 miles. So perspective, you've got the Great Pyramids, the Empire State Building, some of the grandest creations of mankind, and an artist has rendered and put these things to scale with God's creation of Mount Everest, that dwarfs the Empire State Building, dwarfs the pyramids. But now let's zoom out. And this is, again, a scaled rendering of the dimensions given to us of the new city. the New Jerusalem, the heavenly city that will come from the new heaven and dwell on the new earth, 1,400 miles tall, 1,400 miles wide, 1,400 miles deep. And look at the scale. Can you even see Mount Everest? We'll zoom in one more time so you can get an idea and just have our minds blown with the vastness of the city. There's Mount Everest. There's how it compares. All right, and one more time for scale. Oh, big old towers and pyramids, and that's not where I want my investment. That's where not where I want my roots. I want the heavenly city. I look for that city that when you put it in perspective, when you can see that which is afar off through the eyes of faith, rather than focusing on the immediate, we by faith look to the ultimate. Patriarchs, they had to, Romans 4:20 and 21, Abraham staggered not at the promise of God through unbelief, but was strong in faith, giving glory to God and being fully persuaded that what he had promised he was able to perform. I love this for the patriarchs, how the earthly person says, well, God's way seems uncertain, and, you know, Abraham, you ought to stay where you are, but he went past sight's uncertainties. You know, sight would say, look, 90-year-olds don't give birth. But faith says, nothing's impossible for God. Sight says, sons sacrificed by their fathers don't grow up to father nations. Okay, a child that is killed cannot grow up to be a father. But faith says, even death is not a barrier for God because God can raise the dead. That's what Abraham assumed. For sight, it's a barrier. Hey, if Isaac sacrificed, he can't be the father of nations. But Abraham decided that's God's problem to deal with. He has promised, I believe to the point of obedience, despite face uncertainties, because I believe to the end of God's promise. Could you say with these patriarchs, hey, I want to reach the end of my days clinging to this faith. And as I lay a dying, to, verse 21 says, by faith Jacob, when he was a dying, you act in faith, even up to your dying breath, that even you could say, I could reach the end of my life not having realized all my dreams, not having reached all my goals, and still cling confidently to my obedient faith in God, knowing that even if I live my whole life for him and never saw it, his promise will be sure to the end. Chapter 6, verses 12 through 19 give us the assurity that God's promise cannot fail, which hope we have for an anchor of the soul. Because of this faith, I love verse 16, wherefore God is not ashamed to be called their God. In Exodus 3:6, when Moses says, who are you, Lord? Who should I say sent me? And he says, I am sent me. And who are you? He says, I'm the God of your fathers. I'm the God of Abraham. I'm the God of Isaac. I'm the God of Jacob. He's not ashamed to be called their God because they believed to the point of obedience. They obeyed through sight's uncertainties, and they believed to the end of God's promise. Hey, every health and wealth and prosperity feel-good preacher out there can promise, hey, if you have enough faith, your bank account will swell. You will experience success in this earth. Your hurts and diseases can be healed if you have enough faith. The problem is, true faith is believing that God will do all he has promised to do. And all of those promises are earthbound. God has never promised to make you wealthy on earth. God has never promised to heal your sicknesses and hurts and diseases on earth. He can do those things, but they're not promises. God has never promised to give you business success on earth. So no matter how much faith you have, there's no biblical basis to expect those things. Oh, so is God's promise that we have faith in, you know, it's kind of, oh, just doesn't work for any of those big things. It's just like these intangible things. No, that's not it. His promises are much bigger. Oh, if I just had $1 million, so many of my problems would be solved. How short-sighted. How earthbound. Why would you settle for $1 million when God says the meek shall inherit the earth, and I'd rather have faith in that promise? See, God promises fulfillment where the world can only supply vanity. God promises peace where the earth can only supply materialism. God promises lasting joy where the earth can only supply fleeting pleasure. God promises imperishable inheritance where the world can only supply tarnished gold. God supplies and promises an eternal city where the world can only offer passing kingdoms. And so Jesus says, "Lay not up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust doth corrupt and where thieves break through and steal. But lay up for yourself treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust doth corrupt, and where thieves do not break through or steal. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also." Like Abraham, like Sarah, like Isaac and Jacob and Joseph, let's believe to the point of obedience. Let's obey even through sight's uncertainties. And let's anchor that faith in the end of God's